Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the GOP tax plan unveiled, desperation in Puerto Rico, NFL controversy. President Trump says the tax overhaul would be a miracle for the middle class.
This is a revolutionary change, and the biggest winners will be the everyday American workers as jobs start pouring into our country.
In Puerto Rico, desperate Americans asking, where's the help? Here's San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz.
We need to get our together here. And help needs to get into people's hands. Now. Not tomorrow. Not later. Now.
And Tennessee Titans wide receiver Rishard Matthews says he feels under attack by President Trump's NFL comments.
He was calling a lot of us, and I feel that he was calling myself a SOB, and that's, you know, not okay, very disrespectful. So, you know, I plan to kneel until the president apologizes.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kevin Blackstone, Eliana Johnson, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see a middle-class miracle in the GOP tax plan? And who has your sympathy, respect, in the NFL controversy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Kevin Blackstone, sports columnist for The Washington Post, panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. He's also a sports journalism professor at the University of Maryland. Kevin, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here again.
Thanks, Tom.
With us from Washington, Eliana Johnson, national political reporter for Politico. Eliana, welcome back. Great to have you here as well.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kevin, and Eliana.
We have a lot of news to get to, and we will. The NFL controversy, let's just go there first. Here it was a week ago, President Trump in Alabama in a campaign rally for Luther Strange, who would ultimately lose. But in the middle of this rambling rally speech, big crowd there, the president went after NFL players who take a knee during the national anthem. We don't normally air this type of language, but this is what the president said.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
He's fired, and he still wants them fired. He's asking, he's telling the owners, get out there, fire them, if they don't stand up. On NFL game day on Sunday, there were lots of knees taken, lots of arms linked. Here on Sunday, football analyst, former Dallas Cowboys wide receiver Michael Irvin denounced President Trump's comments toward protesting NFL players, saying the president had the wrong priorities.
I put it up against Charlottesville, and I thought to myself, wow, you did not come out with fervor and strongly denounce what you saw in Charlottesville. But you come out with fervor and strongly denounce African-American players exercising their First Amendment right and all players and then owners for not firing these guys.
Kevin Blackstone, at the end of this week, what do you see unfolding in this amazing standoff between the president and it seems in some way most of the NFL?
Sure. Well, I see a very righteous protest started by Colin Kaepernick well over a year ago to protest the extrajudicial killing of black men in this country that was going unchecked by our judicial system, now being usurped by a protest around First Amendment and freedom of speech rights, which former NFL players and current NFL players have found a need or desire to stand up to and against, but yet we're not willing to stand up with or kneel or sit with Colin Kaepernick in his protests. You know, this is easy for them. This is not difficult. And so now what you see are these shows of unity, which is not really a protest at all. You see owners being involved in these, which really dilutes and defines, I think, what the original intent of the protest was. And you see Donald Trump interjecting himself into this debate, really hijacking the media conversation about more critical things going on right now, like what's going on in Puerto Rico, what's going on with the health care bill, what's going on with the educational system and the way public funds are being redirected. And instead, we're talking about this. And I think it's another example of how Trump is really a master manipulator of media messaging.
We'll talk about all these things, but this has been a cultural moment. Eliana Johnson, what's the president asking for here? Why is he in the middle of this, calling football players sons of bitches in a public rally where he knows the cameras are rolling?
I do think the president has a sort of genius for identifying cultural flashpoints and sticking his finger in them, kind of like putting when somebody puts their finger in an electric socket and lights a spark or electrocutes himself. The president seems to do that to the country at large. He has stuck himself in the middle of this in a rally in Alabama, and I think continued going because he saw the crowd's enthusiastic response to what he said. What I do think is interesting is he's backed off urging NFL owners to fire players who take a knee during the anthem and shifted his argument to saying the NFL should institute a rule that players should stand. And I do think the president seems to understand at a deep level that sort of the majority of Americans don't like the visual of somebody, of athletes taking the knee during the anthem. But it is unclear to me whether this debate is going to be about taking a knee or not taking a knee, or whether it's going to be about freedom of speech and the ability to protest. It's not totally clear to me. I think the president's insertion into the debate has kind of muddied it.
I mean, he's definitely sticking with it. Here he was with Fox News yesterday saying NFL owners are scared of their players.
I have so many friends that are owners, and they're in a box. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of them. They say, we are in a situation where we have to do something. I think they're afraid of their players. You want to know the truth. And I think it's disgraceful.
But the players saying, come on, we have a right to protest. This was a Seahawks, Seattle Seahawks wide receiver Doug Baldwin. Grandfather was a 26-year-old career Air Force member saying protest is part of this country's DNA.
This is our country. What we were founded on was a protest. You know, the Boston Tea Party, that was a protest. And I think there's something to be said to make sure that we protect the sanctity and the importance of individuals in this country being able to express themselves.
Kevin Blackstone, the president says this is not racial. What do you say to that?
Oh, well, of course it's racial. The fact of the matter is that, roughly two-thirds of NFL players are black males. When he was in Alabama and he used language to criticize those players by saying those people and talking about our heritage in the state of Alabama in an election between two political figures who are racialized in and of themselves by the things that they've said and they've done, of course, it's racial. Racial. When he talks about the NFL being a watered down product now because it's not as violent as it used to be, and you understand that most of the players who suffer concussions, and just like last night's game in Green Bay, and suffer from CTE, are black players disproportionately. When you understand that the positions that they play mostly in the NFL are the positions that suffer disproportionately from CTE, it is racial. When you talk about when you think about the imagery of Donald Trump saying that he believes that the owners, all of whom are white, are fearful of their players, most of whom are black, that's the black man as the boogie monster in our society. And then when you look at, of course, the history of Donald Trump, not just recently, not just in his campaign, but going all the way back to that lawsuit over housing discrimination in New York City, it is steeped in racial coding, racial language, and all of that.
Jack, is kneeling such an offense? I mean, this is not, I don't know, I mean, we have freedom of speech in this country, but this is not, there's also a noble history of kneeling. I mean, knights of old kneeling, and we kneel in prayer, and is kneeling a kind of a call to the better angels of our nature, even as the anthem plays?
It seems that way to me, and in what I've read, Colin Kaepernick actually came up with the idea after talking to a Navy SEAL, a hero, who suggested that would be an appropriate gesture for just the reasons you're saying, that there's a kind of reverence even in it. But you know, to pick up on what Kevin, I think, masterfully laid out there, the president is he's a master of the politics of distraction. In a press conference the other day, I'm not sure whether it was Monday or Tuesday, there were 12 questions about the NFL and three about Puerto Rico. He created this wedge issue, separating rural white Americans, pitting them against wealthy black athletes, and it's helped him distract from this failure of government that we see in the face of this great disaster in Puerto Rico.
I mean, but you know, here we are, we got a lot to talk about, and we will talk about it. But do we have a president telling the country, or through owners, or whoever, you like, hey, you there, you stand up and do as I say, you salute this flag, you respond to this flag the way I tell you to. Is that the American way?
No, it's the authoritarian way, and it shows just how again and again President Trump just goes to this kind of anti-democratic impulse where he is the czar of America, saying what will be and what won't.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the news of the week, a GOP tax plan, Trump versus the NFL, Puerto Rico in trouble, Tom Price's private jet scandal, Roy Moore, German elections. Eliana Johnson is with us from Politico, national political reporter there. Kevin Blackstone is with us. He's a sports columnist at the Washington Post. You know him from ESPN's Around the Horn. Jack Beatty is with us as well, and you can join us. What do you see in this NFL controversy? What do you see in the response to the needs of Americans in Puerto Rico? And what do you see in the tax plan framework laid out this week by the president and GOP leaders in Congress? What do people think? Iowa City, Iowa. Bruce, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call and say that that President Trump and certainly the governor of our state, Kim Reynolds, as well as our senators, complained that NFL players took a knee because they and were thereby disrespecting the flag and those who fought and died for freedom. And I just want to say that there could be absolutely nothing further from the truth. Protesters knelt to, as they said, to protest police brutality and racism, which continues as a part of their everyday existence as African-Americans. The brutality continues in spite of the fact that African-Americans fought and died in every American war with the hope and expectation that they would enjoy the full fruits of American democracy and opportunity. But this hasn't been the case. The struggle must continue, and I'm proud of these black football players and anyone else who knelt with them. They weren't disrespecting the flag or any armed forces personnel. That's ridiculous. To make this claim, in my view, demonstrates a woeful ignorance, and it's an affront to the black experience of our brothers and sisters, African-American brothers and sisters in the history of this country. So, and I think it's not a distraction for me. It rivets my attention again on these gross inequities that are perpetrated against black people every day.
Bruce, we've got it. Let's get more opinions here, but I very much value yours. One more right here. Cleveland, Ohio. Dale, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to address first President Trump's comments on the NFL event. And I would say that his comments were entirely off base. He should not have resorted to that type of language. With that said, I would also like to address some of the comments that have been made this morning on other things with the NFL. First of all, saying that this is an affront to black players, I think is absolutely ridiculous. Let's remember NFL teams are made up of white and black players, and any player playing is doing so at their own choice. None of them are appointed to that team, and none of them are drafted to that team. Is it an affront to the honor of this country? It most certainly is. It has been since day one that our flag, the only thing appropriate to do to our flag was to stand up and stand at attention or salute it or cross your heart.
What's wrong with kneeling to say let's go for the higher ideals of our nation, Dale? What's wrong with that? Is it kind of an appeal to fellow citizens to make it better?
Well, where are we drawing that from? Are we drawing that conclusion from kneeling, that it is looking for higher values? I don't know that that's all of the protesters are saying. That's just an assumption here.
Well, I mean, they're saying let's not be. I mean, Colin Kaepernick was trying to draw attention to police brutality. Surely we can agree that's not a great thing.
Okay, calling attention to police brutality, and this is something we hear as a cry across our nation again, that the police are being brutal to black youth. What about the times where American youth or American people, this is so sickening, it's not even funny. I mean...
Black youths are American people. Where are you going there, Dale?
I agree they are black. They are people.
American people. Of course they are.
So they are. Okay, then why are we separating out the black youth?
Well, because I think it's because of the experience that they have lived. But I appreciate your call. We've got your view. One more. Jeff in Sarasota, Florida. Jeff, you're on.
Hello, Tom. I love your show, man. It's the best on there. I'm a former Green Beret. I served my country 6 years, and I totally support the players' right to kneel and draw attention to police brutality. You know, I have another friend's a veteran. He says, I didn't sign up to sweep this whole phenomena of police brutality under the rug. And I took an oath to protect and uphold the Constitution of the United States. And there's a reason why the First Amendment is first, because it's the very foundation of our freedom. And you know, I just, anyone that's trying to suppress the Constitution is an enemy of the state. And that's what Donald Trump is doing. He's trying to suppress our rights to free speech, and it's wrong, and I think we need to unite and speak out against him, and I love your show.
Jeff, I appreciate your call. Eliana Johnson, how do you think at the end of this week, and we're going to go to Puerto Rico in 22 seconds here, but how do you think the president feels about the way this is playing out? I mean, he sparked this. He got this all going. Is this good for him, bad for him?
Look, as a political issue overall, I think it's probably good for the president, but I don't actually think that matters. I think that there's a real debate to be had in this country about community policing and the ways to improve it. I think there's a real debate to be had about whether or not it's appropriate to stand for the national anthem. But what the president has done by injecting himself into the debate is made whether or not to stand at the national anthem, a referendum on whether or not you support or oppose the president, which is ridiculous. And I think that his injection into some of these debates kind of muddies the waters of important cultural debates that should be had in this country, some of which he's brought to the surface, but some of which his inserting himself into really shifts the subject in unhelpful ways.
Kevin Blackstone, last word on the NFL controversy?
I think one thing that people should understand is that it wasn't until 2009 that the NFL asked or required teams to come out of the locker room and stand on the sidelines for the national anthem. And people should also know that it wasn't until the World Series between the Cubs, or it was when the World Series, during the World Series between the Cubs and the Red Sox during the run-up to World War I, when Woodrow Wilson decreed that any military band playing in a public setting would have to play the Star Spangled Banner, which at that time was not the national anthem. The mm-hmm. country did not have a national anthem. So just to let people know that militarism and the packaging of sports in patriotism and nationalism has a lot to do with why we're having this discussion today.
I mean, people say, Jack, don't make it political, but the U.S. military has done all kinds of marketing around professional sports games and football in particular, the jet flyovers and all the rest. I mean, there's the politicizing right there. I mean, they can buy that time. They can buy that advertising. They can get in the middle of it with sponsorship, but don't pretend it's not political.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been true for years now, and especially after 9/11, the wave of patriotism and sort of patriotism, subsidized patriotism.
I mean, I'm for it, but don't tell me how to celebrate it and honor it. What about freedom here? We got to turn to Puerto Rico. The cries from Puerto Rico have been really acute and becoming more so as the days go by. It's an island. It's hard to reach. We get that. The devastation is overwhelming there, the power grid down and all the rest. But the question is, has the mainland been sufficiently on its toes in helping out its fellow Americans there in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands alongside the government saying, the Trump administration, yes, we have. Here's Acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke yesterday describing relief efforts in Puerto Rico.
We have been working on yesterday, principally getting distribution, that last mile, as they call it. To do that, we had to remove debris, we had to restore roads, we had to clear landslides across the island, and we have done things like airdrops in the meantime.
Okay, we get it. It's not easy. The devastation is deep and real, and Puerto Rico has water all around it, as the president immediately points out. But there are ways and there are ways. Here's Lieutenant General Russell Honoré. This is the leader of the U.S. military's response to Hurricane Katrina. He was talking this week with NPR's Rachel Martin on Morning Edition just yesterday about the difference in the disaster relief effort given to those affected by Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico versus Hurricane Katrina back in 2005.
The force is on only about 2,200 federal troops. We're in support of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands as of yesterday.
How many do you think they need?
Puerto Rico is a bigger and tougher mission than Katrina. And we had 20,000 federal troops, 20 ships, and 40,000 National Guard. Now you figure that out.
Now you figure that out, says the military man who was in charge of supplementing relief efforts around Hurricane Katrina. I mean, 20,000 federal troops, 40,000 National Guard, 20 ships, and that was for Katrina. Eliana, is it clear whether there's been a failure to stand up with sufficient speed in the case of Puerto Rico?
I have to say, I don't think it's at all clear. I don't exactly remember the press lauding the President Bush's response to Hurricane Katrina. So it's kind of ironic, I think, to hear people citing that as an example of effective disaster relief.
Well, I don't mean that, but there is the guy who was in charge of the military just simply pointing out the difference in military assets immediately thrown at it.
I understand, but using the Katrina response as a comparison to the response to Puerto Rico just doesn't seem quite right to me.
I hear you.
It's difficult to know because the governor of Puerto Rico has been nothing but laudatory about the Trump administration's response, and it's unclear to me sort of how else to measure it, because with a natural disaster, there's a certain level of devastation and, you know, really heartbreaking stories that are going to come out of it. So as a reporter, it's just been somewhat difficult for me to measure. I'm talking to people at FEMA who are working around the clock. I think the biggest mistake, it seems to me, that the administration made was in not waiving the Jones Act, which requires any shipments between two U.S. ports to be done by U.S. ships, and not waiving that immediately because it seems to have prevented relief supplies from getting there. But right now, it also seems like the problem is not the amount of supplies that are on the island, but getting them distributed throughout the island. That seems to be the heart of the issue.
Of course, the military could help with that as well. General Honoré is saying, get helicopters in there. Get more air support in there. Jack Beatty, do you see the government of Puerto Rico as laudatory, the administration's support efforts there because they're sufficient or because they're afraid if they criticize this president, he'll step on the hose?
I think more of the latter. He's been very careful to flatter the president, knowing that that's something the president craves. But the mayor of San Juan has been more candid. She responded, you quoted Elaine Duke, the acting head of Homeland Security. She went on to say, quote, this is the relief effort, quote, is a good news story. The mayor of San Juan, she replied, damn it. This is not a good news story. It's a people are dying story. That's the candid response from there.
Muhammad is calling from New York City. Hi, Muhammad. You're on the air.
The thing that I wanted to point out is that watching the Vietnam series by Ken Burns and Lynn Novak that just finished last night, if the Trump administration wanted to put all efforts into providing relief in Puerto Rico, the only thing that has to be done, it seems to me, and it seems somewhat simplistic, but it does require a lot of planning, and that is a squadron of helicopters can move heavy equipment, trailers into the interior of Puerto Rico to provide our relief supplies and medical personnel, et cetera. So I think that the same thing applies to Puerto Rico, the way this administration has been slow to react to the humanitarian crisis there, is the same thing that applies to the NFL, and that is it's race. It's all about race, the other, in my opinion.
Muhammad, we've got it. Kevin Blackstone, do you see logistical challenges here? Come on, it takes time to get in there. Or do you see a kind of a second-class citizenship being played out?
I work with a young woman who's from Puerto Rico, and I checked in with her after after Irma to see if her people were okay, and she said, "Yeah, they were fine." And I checked in with her this time, and she's headed there right now, somehow, any way she can to get there. It's interesting to me when I think about it. I think about the U.S. military they very easily and quickly can get to the island of Vieques,
where they Puerto do artillery Rico training and all the rest.
Exactly, Puerto Rico is a great destination for tourists who want to go there for the beaches, and it's a great destination for Major League Baseball who goes there to get baseball players. And the images that you see on television of people jerry-rigging wires across swollen rivers to hold on to just get to dry land, and the fact that they haven't been they haven't had any contact with the government, but yet reporters can watch them on camera, suggests to me that this is a horrible this is a lousy response to a tragedy. And then the other thing I'll just point out. Is that there was a brilliant speech given at the General Session of the UN last week, the 72nd session, by the Foreign Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, where he pointed out that it is – I want to get his quote right, but I think he said, the tragedy is that those of us who are least responsible for climate change – are most heavily devastated by its results.
One more
call
here.
And that's what we see happening in Puerto Rico and across the Caribbean.
We've got it, Kevin. Jennifer in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Jennifer, thank you for calling. Our time's short before the break, but you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your show. It's an island of sanity in this crazy world that we're in right now. I just wanted to say that I have a son who serves in the military. He has served with so many Puerto Ricans, and they are Americans. And it just breaks my heart that we as, you know, here on the mainland have not responded as we should. And I think it's a travesty that President Trump has diverted attention from this disaster. And it just really saddens me. They're Americans and they served well.
But are you ready to cut the government some slack here? As the president says, it's surrounded by water. It's not easy to get there. The hurricane came on, you know, awfully fast here. Are you willing to cut some slack to the government?
No, I'm not. It's not new news that it's surrounded by water. We knew it was surrounded by water before the hurricane hit. The government should have prepared, just as it prepared for Houston, for Harvey. It should have, and in Florida, the preparation was excellent there. It should have prepared for Puerto Rico, too.
Jennifer, we've got it. It's hard to be without statehood, but to be without help in a storm, that's tough if that's what's happening here. Jennifer, thank you for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a series of deadly rock slides at Yosemite National Park, leaving one person dead. NBC's Miguel Almaguer reports.
Oh, I can still see it falling.
One boulder the size of an apartment building, careening down the face of El Capitan, killing one person, a second seriously injured.
Watch out below. Saudi Arabia has granted women the right to drive, ending a ban on female drivers as of next year. One Saudi Arabian woman welcomed the change here.
I'm ready. My daughter is ready. And also society is ready. How much longer can we live in an oppressive society that prevents us from our full rights?
And Hugh Hefner, founder of Playboy, dead at 91, he turned his magazine into a lifestyle empire and changed the way people talk about sex.
Good evening. I'm Hugh Hefner, your host. This is Barbie Benton.
The whole idea behind Playboy was to try to put sex back into the total fabric of the interests of man.
Yeah, I think it's there in the fabric. We're looking at the news of the week with Kevin Blackstone, sports columnist for The Washington Post. Eliana Johnson, national political reporter for Politico, and our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join us this hour. What do you see coming on taxes and the tax cuts Republicans have on the table now, the president has on the table? What about Roy Moore? Are you picturing a Senator Roy Moore from Alabama on Capitol Hill? What about Republicans in health care, all the difficulty they've had on that front? Can you picture Rick Pitino not courtside at college basketball scandal there this week? Tom Price and his private jet flights, how do those strike you? And are you watching Twitter and the Russians, results from the German elections, Saudi Arabia and women driving there, the new U.S. travel ban? The president in Indianapolis on Wednesday saying his tax plan would create a miracle for the middle class.
Democrats and Republicans in Congress should come together, finally, to deliver this giant win for the American people and begin middle-class miracle. It's called a middle-class miracle once again.
Eliana Johnson, we saw a tough week for health care yet again for the GOP. What about on the tax front? Does it look as though they may have something here? We haven't seen all the details yet that they can pass.
Well, they have a plan, which is more than they had on health care for a long time. And it doesn't appear to be quite as slapdash as the couple of health care plans we saw that House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell attempted to rush through. But what's most surprising to me is that it doesn't appear that the plan has targeted middle-class tax cuts. And I do think there's an opening for really potentially damaging attacks to be directed at the administration if the tax cuts are targeted toward the top 1%, because the president really campaigned as a champion of the little guy, the middle class. And I think it's a huge mistake if in the end the middle class doesn't see some sort of tax relief in the plan that's put forward.
Are those still coming, Eliana? I mean, that's the sort of black hole in the framework that was laid out. The cuts, tax cuts for wealthier Americans, fairly clear in what's been described, but fairly obscure in the middle. Could they still be out there?
I think they could be, but it's not clear right now, and it doesn't seem to be a real focus of the administration. The president has talked quite a bit about the corporate tax rate and wanting to get that down. His ideal was 15%. He talked a lot about that. Looks like they want to go with a 20% tax rate, change the rate on pass-through entities and so on. But I'm just surprised. I think the messaging is almost more important here right out of the gate, and I'm shocked not only that they sent Gary Cohn out to talk about this, who's not exactly the face of the middle class in this country, and his messaging seems somewhat bungled to me. He talked about $100,000 being the average salary of a family in this country, but also that right out of the gate, there wasn't an enormous focus on what the average family is going to get in tax relief.
Gary Cohn, worth hundreds of millions, White House economic advisor, coming out saying a middle-class American family making $100,000 a year would save $1,000 on their taxes under the Republican tax reform. Okay, we'll see about that. And what could they do with that? Boy, they could do a lot with that $1,000. Here he was.
If we allow a family to keep another $1,000 of their income, what does that mean? They can renovate their kitchen. They can buy a new car. They can take a family vacation. They can increase their lifestyle. That's what our tax plan is to do. Our tax plan is aimed to return more income back to hardworking Americans. That's what we're trying to do here.
Jack Beatty, that $1,000 remodeling of your kitchen, what's that going to buy? That $1,000 car, boy, that's a dreamboat.
Yeah, Mr. Cohen is in touch, isn't he, with the realities of American life. You know, just focus on him for a minute. It's kind of pathetic that this man who was on the verge of resigning in principle after the president's disgraceful comments following about Charlottesville, notably his glossing over the anti-Semitism that was on display there, Cohen told, actually, I think I'd even seen some versions that he'd written out his resignation, but he said, I have to stay on to be able to get tax reform for the American people. And this is the tax reform he's talking about. You know, Donald Trump says, I'm not going to benefit from this. The New York Times estimates that he will enjoy a windfall of perhaps more than $1 billion from this tax cut. Trump had the wit to challenge at the last minute, this according to Axios, the package that was put together because he noticed that it increased the taxes, the rate that the poorest Americans pay from 10 to 12%, while cutting the rate that the richest pay from 39 to 35. And he said, gee, people are going to make something of that. Well, they are, and the Democrats aren't going to let them forget that.
Kevin, you know, the president says, look, the miracle is that these changes in corporate tax and the rest will rev up the economy, and that will mean jobs and higher-paying jobs. He was very explicit about this in Indiana. That's supposed to be the miracle here. Do you think people will be ready to buy that if they don't have just buy it, period, Kevin?
You know, before I covered sports, I covered economics, mm-hmm. and I well remember trickle-down theory and how it never really worked. And so, you know, I look back at the last 8-10 years, and you one of the things that jumps out to you about the finances of corporate America in this country is that their coffers got fatter and fatter over the last decade than they had ever been before. They were very reticent to hire, and even more so to increase wages. So for people to believe that this tax plan is going to work in their favor if they're in the middle class is foolhardy. And the other thing I just have to point out, because I know you're going to get to it, juxtapose this conversation to what we see with the use of airliners paid for by the public, by the members of this cabinet, who are the wealthiest members we've ever seen in a cabinet before. And so to me, that tells you all you need to know about the tax plan and who is going to be protected and who's going to be paying for it.
It's going to be
workers, and the wealthy are going to get away with it.
Well, we'll see. Eliana, the president says that, look, we need higher growth. He promised it on the campaign trail, make America great again, growth like you can't believe, winning so much you'll get bored of it. He was tweeting yesterday that in his during his administration, GDP revised upward to 3.1% for the last quarter. And he tweets, many people thought it would be years before that happened. We have just begun! Exclamation mark. Now, people are coming in here and pointing out that level of growth, we saw it under Barack Obama in 2009, 2010, 11, 2013, 2014, and 15, had 8 quarters of the growth as good as that. Highest was 5.2%. But this president needs to show that kind of growth. Is he pinning his hopes on his tax cuts to make that happen, Eliana?
A couple of things. The first is that the president fudging the facts on Twitter or anywhere else is sadly not surprising. Clearly somebody who takes liberties with the truth on a regular basis. But the second is that the economy actually has been quite good under President Trump, and I think it's something that's greatly helping his general approval ratings, even as they are not great generally. And I do think that the the way that the economy performs over the next year is something that will hugely impact the midterm elections. And that, yes, it's one of the reasons that Republicans are desperate to pass a tax cut, in addition to the fact that they absolutely need something substantive to show and to campaign on ahead of the 2018 midterm elections.
We've got Tom Price, Secretary of Health and Human Services, with his private jets and military jets that he ordered up there on Wednesday, walking onto Marine One. President Trump said he's not happy about all that.
I am going to see. I'm looking at that very closely. I am not happy with it. I will tell you, I am not happy with it.
I'm not happy with it. We'll see where that goes. Here's Tom Price telling Fox News yesterday he would reimburse the government, in a fashion, for a series of private flights he took, and he would stop the practice.
There will be no private air charters at HHS going forward.
Of course, he's offering to pay something like $50,000, $50,000+, Eliana, but I've seen estimates of upwards toward $1 million of what those flights actually cost, and he's not the only cabinet member who has gotten into the private jet game here. If I get it right, his successor under Obama, was it Kathleen Sebelius, Jack, who never took a private jet, or maybe one time somewhere in Alaska where it was the only way to get around?
That's what I've read. And she was quoted as saying that she never at all took a military jet.
Eliana, what's up with this? Is there a new sort of habit or presumption on the part of cabinet members now that they'd deserve military jets to fly to see the eclipse of the sun or honeymoon or whatever it may be?
I cannot stress enough what a damaging story I think this is for the administration. To directly respond to your question, I think there's not been a ton of oversight of cabinet secretaries and an institution of rules and regulations over this kind of thing by the Trump administration. But to have a Republican congressman who campaigned against this sort of thing and railed against excessive government spending and abuse of taxpayer dollars, spending over $1 million on private airline flight, is precisely the sort of thing that Donald Trump campaigned against. And to have this story come out precise in a drip, drip, drip fashion over 1.5 weeks is really damaging for the administration. And it's the sort of thing that risks having that risk for the president alienating his base. I have to think that he's going to do something about this. He is hopping mad about it. And it's weird. He has a kind of delayed response about these things. It takes him a few days to act. He does not like firing people, but I would anticipate some action in this, about this on President Trump's part in the coming, couple days.
Plenty of others in this boat or on this jet. Ryan Zinke, Secretary of Interior, on an oil executive flight, home to Montana, I think. Of course, that was paid for by taxpayers, $12,000 for his seat on that plane, but then flying with an oil executive, Secretary of Interior. Okay. Wayne in Atlanta. Wayne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. I just wanted to mention Tom Price, who actually comes from a little town, Dublin, in Georgia, where I grew up, went to high school.
Yeah.
This guy is getting taking these trips, and he's being jumped on about it. He's not the only one. I forget the name and position of another official of the administration who had a plane to take he and his new bride on their honeymoon. And when something was mentioned about it, he jumped up with some half-baked story about needing to go to Fort Knox and check on the gold there. It's just beyond ridiculous. But these people are doing what their boss does. Do you know how many of our tax dollars are being blown to take care of Mar-a-Lago, Trump Tower in New York? it's ridiculous.
Hey, Wayne, didn't you have a private military jet for your honeymoon, Wayne?
Of course I did.
Wayne, I appreciate your call. Our time's getting short here, but we take the point. Eliana, we have to turn to you on health care. The Republicans folded their tent again this week. Maybe not forever, but for now. How big a setback is that? Will they sit down and work with Democrats or come back and fight next year?
most surprising thing to me was that President Trump told donors at a closed-door fundraiser in New York City on Tuesday night that he wanted to try again in the new year. But I just think the process on the attempted repeal of Obamacare has been so totally botched by Republicans in Congress. The attempt to do it quickly rather than devoting an entire year to something that was going to be enormously difficult to do. Barack Obama spent 2 years trying to push it through Congress. I think Republicans should have been patient and methodical and really made sure they had majorities rather than trying to ram slapdash solutions through, in a 3 week time period.
Germans with their election, Angela Merkel back in power. But now with the far right AfD in power, too, I've heard Germans call them Nazis. Watch that space. And Kevin Blackstone in Alabama. You've got Roy Moore's victory over the man that Donald Trump supported, Luther Strange. Steve Bannon supporting Roy Moore. This is the former judge who was kicked out for insisting on putting a Ten Commandments statue in the front of the courthouse. But here he is. He'll be fighting for a seat in the U.S. Senate. What do you make of it, Kevin?
It's just representative of a faction of society that has, I hate to use this phraseology, but risen up. And is now in Washington, and we have connected this this presidency to white supremacist ideology, and this is another result of it.
Eliana, is it a setback for the president that his man didn't win or not?
You know, I honestly don't think so, because both of these candidates were claiming to campaign in the name of President Trump. I actually think it's a testament to his enormous political power.
Power that's there right now. Jack Beatty, can you see it? Senator Roy Moore in our times?
It's going to be a shock, and the person who'll be most shocked is Mitch McConnell. This is not what he wanted.
Mitch McConnell, who poured millions into trying to keep Roy Moore out of the U.S. Senate. Now he will contest it with Doug Jones there in Alabama. I want to thank all three of you for being with us this hour. Really terrific to have you. What a week. Kevin Blackstone, sports columnist of The Washington Post, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. You see him on ESPN's Around the Horn. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Eliana Johnson, national political reporter for Politico. Eliana, great to have you here.
Thanks, Jack.
Jack, thanks as always.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.